All right, everybody, welcome into another episode of Debate Night. We've got some very exciting topics to go over today. Just want to introduce the cast to you. Returning, as always, we've got Brody Smith.
Want to apologize to everyone. Last week, I went over my time multiple times, and I was too passionate with my responses. So I will be much more monotone and quick this week.
All right. We got Hunter here.
I just would like to say that I'm sitting in a sauna, and I had an AC unit on to keep me comfortable and cool, and they made me turn that off, so now I'm miserable.
That's bad for production, and we would like to – everybody just keep an eye on Hunter in that bottom left corner.
I might pass out.
We got Tyler joining us today.
What's up, everybody? Thank you for your sacrifice, Hunter. Appreciate that. I'm excited to be here.
And then joining us as well, the formidable Dustin.
You know, here as always, baby, just to do my job. What can I say?
All right, so we're gonna jump right in with our first topic. This is one that I kind of plucked from social media a bit. I believe the original tweet was something along the lines of, every time Terry Miller, this is as close as I can get to the actual quote, but they said, every time Terry Miller refers to Jacob Cordis as cupcake, the sport loses a bit of professionalism. This started a bit of a stir. A lot of people didn't really like that tweet. We talked about it a little bit on Grip Block, like the use of nicknames in commentary. And my question is, you know, does the use of these nicknames sound unprofessional? Is it an unprofessional look for disc golf? Is there a balance with the nickname situation? You know, how should it be handled? Or is it just no big deal at all? You know, what should we really be thinking about this? Brody, what do you think?
I mean, I think nicknames is a very common thing in sports. Now, obviously, there's a big difference between shortening of someone's name, right, and an actual nickname. For example, Baby Shark just won this past weekend in the UFC, and they mentioned her nickname multiple times throughout the telecast. I think disc golf sometimes, and maybe this is what the person was alluding to, I think sometimes, and this happens in all commentary, but I think in disc golf specifically with people that maybe aren't professionally trained or have gone into a commentary background, they sometimes hammer things in way too often. They just go back to the well and say it over and over and over and over again. So I kind of see if you're hearing cupcake for the 1,000th time in a broadcast being like it's a little bit overdone. I don't think cupcake... Well, I didn't know what his name was actually before Cupcake. So, like, he might actually be a good example of he kind of goes by Cupcake. I know you guys said on Grip Locked whether or not, like, that is what he wants to be known by. I think the other thing, too, the part that the part that I think needs to get fixed is when commentators have, like, these close relationships with some of these players. And, like, for example, Hunter. If I call Hunter Big Hunt, and no one else calls Hunter Big Hunt, if I'm on broadcast and I'm like, Big Hunt with the big putt, like, people are going to be like, what the heck? So there's a difference between, like, a common nickname that everyone understands that is what that person's nickname is and, like, your personal nickname for someone. I know they start calling, was it Deanne Carey that one tournament? Diesel or something?
Diesel, yeah.
And, like, everyone was like, what? Where did this come from? So I think it just depends on the person, depends on the nickname, popularity.
Well, you were on his card in Vegas, if I remember correctly. Not like Vegas as in the Halloween tournament. Mm-hmm. Do you not remember? Like, how did he introduce himself?
Well, no, I knew him before that. Okay. I got introduced to him, and I know the cupcake story. I'm trying to remember what it was.
If you were like, if you had to make a call, like, were you calling him Cupcake?
Yeah, oh, 100%.
Okay. 100%. Right. That's what I wanted to know. All right, Hunter, what do you think about the nicknames?
Yeah, I mean, I think nicknames in sports almost go hand in hand to a certain extent. So I don't think it's that big of a deal at all. I mean, for example, we have Babe Ruth, Tiger Woods, King James, Magic Johnson, Booger McFarlane. None of those are their real names, in case you weren't aware of that. But I think where it does get iffy is, in my experience, is not so much Terry. I think there's other commentators. Ian comes to mind when they just refer to people as Vinny. I would imagine he would exclusively do Cupcake. Trying to think of any other nicknames, but where they exclusively refer to them as Emmer Daddy. Gosh, Emmer Daddy, if I hear that one more time. Where that gets, like, driven kind of to Brody's point, where it gets, like, pounded into your head. I think that's more so where it becomes unprofessional. But if we're worried about the professionalism of the broadcast and the sport, I think that there's other things we need to be attacking before we get to this nickname issue.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Tyler, what do you think about the whole deal?
This made me laugh, just this question and then seeing the tweet. I think, well, for one thing, and this is nothing against Terry. Terry does an incredible job of these tournaments of trying to provide coverage pretty much all by himself. But criticizing the Memorial as being unprofessional is a tough sell. Like, it's not – the coverage of the Memorial is not intended to be professional. It's like walking into Chipotle and getting steak on your burrito and then sending it back because it wasn't cooked to your liking. Like, it's a tough sell for me. But because Terry Miller is doing his absolute best. And so, but as far as nicknames go, I think we need more nicknames. I like the nicknames. I think it's fun. It may not be professional, but I think it's fun for disc golf. We need more. So I have a few I'd like to propose and see how they land for you guys. We'll see if you want to use any more. So
no.
Since he's coming back and playing Waco this weekend, I've got Nico Disastro. Okay. For Gannon Burr, the baby giraffe.
I like that one.
I like that one.
I like that.
If you ever seen a baby giraffe, like, first learn how to walk, it's uncanny. This one I'm super excited about. Anthony, the ankle breaker, Barella. A.B., the ankle breaker.
I like it.
So,
more
nicknames in disc golf.
Okay. All right, Dustin, more nicknames, less nicknames?
I didn't get any of those.
How do you not get the baby giraffe?
You didn't get the ankle breaker?
Yeah, the baby giraffe.
Wait, what's the ankle breaker?
He hit his ankles. What do you mean?
Yeah.
He broke his ankles?
He didn't break it, but I'm sure he feel good. The disc. His ankle. What a hazard.
The guy he threw.
The guy that got hit.
Oh.
Come on, Brody.
Okay. This is that was not a part of my time. We need to make that very clear.
Yeah, sorry. That went way over my head.
All right, so for me with the nickname thing, first off, I just want to say the most important thing is how does the player want to be referred to as? Coming from a commentator background myself, like, I always want to show respect to the player and what they want to be referred to, so that whether that's pronouncing their name correctly or if they have a nickname they want to go by, I think that's really huge. And I think generally nicknames in disc golf is fine. Like, we see it all the time. Now, granted, some of them are just shortened versions of their name, like Yuli or Big Germ. But when we have Albert the Bazooka Tam, I mean, we have a couple of little nicknames like that in disc golf where I think that it's fine. It's commonplace in MMA. I think Brody brought that up, that it's kind of like inserted kind of in the middle of their name, like Dustin the Diamond Poirier, for example. And then the other sports have it too. Like, Shaq used to be called the Diesel, if we're talking about the Diesel. Then you got Tyrann Mathieu, who's the Honey Badger, who currently plays in the NFL. I think the issue with the Cordis one is just Cupcake sounds kind of silly, right? Like, it stands out more than other nicknames for that reason. But if he likes that name and that's how he's referred to normally, then I think it's fine to use it. What I will say, though, to kind of end it, is that, like, as a commentator, I try to make sure I do this, that you can't assume that the viewers know everyone's nicknames, right? They can get confused on who you're referring to when you're doing the coverage. And I think that's, like, more the issue rather than whether it's professional or not to use a nickname. So I think you have to make sure that you're balancing it as a commentator, bouncing between the two.
Yeah, fair point there. I think that is a key, is at least the first time you introduce the player, at the very least, making sure that you throw in that AKA, which I believe Terry Miller did do. So credit for that. But I think that's the tricky part. I love Hunter throwing a Cupcake Cordis into the mix of Babe Ruth, Tiger Woods. That's my favorite.
He's young in his career, man. Do you think when Tiger Woods was first called that, he was already a GOAT?
Yeah.
Cupcake Cordis actually sounds sick. I think if you went with that, it would actually sound way better if you just, instead of calling him Cupcake.
Yeah, I see that.
Quick side note, based on a comment to allude to, like, people were saying whether he likes being called that or not. Someone did say that he told the announcer at a tournament they were playing with him to call him Cupcake, like, when I'm calling his name. So it seems like in this case he does want to call that.
Fair enough. All right, quick points update right now. We got Brody and Hunter at 4 points, Tyler and Dustin sitting at 3. Next topic, speaking kind of the AB ankle breaker situation. The PDGA currently has a rule that allows players provision in the event of intentional interference. This would be like a member of the gallery jumping out and swatting a disc, for example. And that provision allows them either to play it from where it was contacted or to rethrow without a penalty. Should they add a provision that relates to unintentional interference, such as a volunteer being hit by a disc in bounds, such as the AB hitting a rangefinder volunteer and landing in the hazard? Or is it just part of the game? That's kind of the question here. Hunter, what do you think?
So personally, like, I don't think they should add it. I don't think that it should be a rule, but it almost needs to be based on, like, how do you assume someone's intent in the gallery, whether it was intentional or not intentional. That's a very weird line to lay on the card of whether someone was supposed to be hit or not, or was trying to hit the disc or not. But regardless, I think instead of a rule being in place, it should be more so a focus of the Pro Tour or the PDGA at majors to make sure that the gallery and or volunteers are out of the way where they can't be hit, or if they are hit, it was a very bad shot. Because you also have to think of ways that rules will be abused. And if you know that I, as a player, can hit a spectator and get a rethrow, there are chances of that being abused, of making like a more aggressive shot, knowing if it doesn't make it way back in, I might get a rethrow. And you might be thinking, oh, that would never happen. Well, I can just point you to the foot fault rule and how that had to get changed, because previously with the warning, it was a rethrow. And why it ended up getting changed is there were several scenarios where two buddies are on a card, a shot would go OB, and it happened to be that's the one that's called a foot fault. So I think you have to be a little bit logical with it, but already having an unintentional rule, you almost have to, just because how do you determine someone's intent?
Yeah, the intent situation does make it weird. Tyler, what do you think about it?
Yeah, I think this is a situation where it's almost like a no-brainer. You're kind of watching it happen, and we all saw what happened, and we all felt like, oh man, like there should be some way that he should be able to absolve that, whether it's a rethrow. I think the hard part, just because disc golf can be so wonky and there are so many, you know, crazy unpredictable bounces and things that can happen, is we're not going to be able to think of every situation and add a provisional for every situation that might happen, just because, again, it can be so wacky. My solution would be mulligans. Give each player one mulligan that they can use at some point during the rounds. Like if it's a four tournament, four round tournament, a mulligan in the first two, a mulligan in the second two, and you got one, you can use it anytime you want. You got to use it before hole 16. So coming down the stretch, there's the mulligans in play. But I mean, that would have been a time where AB was like, well, I got to use it. Like, this is my one mulligan. Other than that, you got to play the course how it is. If somebody swats your disc down, then I don't know. That's a different story. But I think mulligans are the answer.
Dustin, mulligans? What do you think?
No mulligans for me, buddy. No mulligans for me. Like, look, I actually wrestle with this a lot because I'm still not totally sure how I'd want to do it. Like, your gut reaction when you watch it happen is that it's heartbreaking to see it happen. And obviously, we'd all love that it didn't happen. And we kind of, I think, naturally just want to see him somehow not be penalized and get through it. But I think the main fix, what happened to AB, is not a rule change. It's more about personnel placement on the course, particularly people who are in bounds on the course, right? Now, I think if you're a player and you throw over out of bounds, you are taking that risk that it's not coming back, right? And yeah, we need to make sure that we're keeping spectators away from being too close to the OB line. That's more for their safety than anything else, I think. And so it just kind of turns into a big gray area. So I think just out of bounds is like that, you're taking that risk when you throw it. Now, when we're talking about inbounds, yes, we should certainly have a rule for blatant interference, like some guy just runs up and grabs your disc and like leaves with it off the fairway. Like, yeah, obviously we have to have the situation rectify that. But let me ask you this. What if AB was definitely 100% going in the hazard and him hitting that guy stopped him from going in? Now, are we going to call unintentional interference and say he should be out of bounds or something like that? Like, I think it gets really murky waters when you have that situation. We also aren't always going to have a clear view of what happened. Remember, we have video evidence here. We're not always going to have that on the course, right? Or maybe the players on the car are not always going to have the best view of what happened. What if it was a blind shot, right? Then how do you know if there was interference or not? And I do think the whole intent thing that Hunter brought up is an interesting one. But I think in this situation, it's such a rare occurrence. And there's a different solution than changing the rules, in my opinion, to help solve it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Brody, how do you see it?
Well, first off, Tyler might be onto something. If we're trying to increase these prizes, like these prize purses, that's an easy way of doing it, is have everyone be able to spend hundreds of dollars on mulligans. Like, you can buy a mulligan for $100.
There you go.
And you might have some people spend $1,000 on mulligans, and all of a sudden now the prize purses are tripled. But no, I don't think this is a rule. I think when it comes to deciding, like, when I think like of intentional interference, I'm thinking of like someone taking their hat off and throwing it up in the air to try to hit it. I'm thinking of a disc rolling and they kick it. I'm thinking of like something very blatantly obvious that the disc was going to do something different if it wasn't interfered with. But I don't like the idea of adding in this rule, because I agree with a lot what was said earlier about how people could potentially use this to kind of favor their positions in certain situations. I would kind of disagree a little bit with what Dustin was saying about, you know, if you do throw out of bounds, you have to realize, like, or if you do throw, excuse me, like a shot that's out of bounds and you're hoping it to come back, you have to realize, like, that's a risk you're willing to take. I think it goes with what Hunter was saying. There are certain holes where we should have an idea of this is the shot shape. This is what most players are going to be going for. And if that is throwing a shot out of bounds and having it try to come back in, we should not put spectators there, not just because they're going to get in the way of the disc potentially getting back in bounds, but also for safety reasons. Like, yeah, we should not be chucking discs over people on purpose. I just think we've gotten lucky to where someone hasn't seriously got injured. You know, we're making jokes about the ankle breaker. I actually don't know if he broke his ankle. I don't know actually how he's doing, but my guess is, like, if we keep going down this path of having more fans, having more shots like this, someone could seriously get injured. And I think that's the last thing we're all looking for.
I would say I would agree. It's honestly surprising that people haven't gotten badly hurt. Sometimes you see throws towards the gallery. I think disc golf is unique in the sense of, in golf, that ball is going to be, I mean, you see people getting very close to golf shots in the gallery, but you're never really playing for ground play to get you back in bounds. The ball's airborne like the whole time for its flight most of the time. So it is different in the sense that you're right, Brody. There are certain holes that are designed where there might even be holes where players are almost always going to challenge the OB, yes, and play for a skip, especially at Vegas when they know the skip is coming. So that may be something where it's like, hey, we need to make a gap here in the gallery because this is where most of the drives are going to be skipping. But, you know, there is also, as to Dustin's point, the player can see them all standing there. So they do know when they're throwing that way that they are there for better or for worse. So it is an interesting issue to see. That's just kind of golf, though, isn't it? You know, there's always going to be situations like that that are just part of the game. All right. So a little points update before we move on. We got Brody sitting at 6 points, Hunter and Dustin at 8, and Tyler at 5. Moving into our next topic. This is one that that kind of, I think, is a little bit interesting. It's something that I feel like has been kind of decided on by the public, but I kind of wanted to bring it up in front of this panel. We recently had the Memorial Championship go down this past weekend. You know, that features birdie or die golf, ended up in an exciting three-way playoff. Memorial's kind of taken off the tour. It's kind of been decided as a consensus that this is not really the style of golf that's wanted out on tour. A lot of hyzers, a lot of birdies. However, it's undeniably was a pretty exciting finish, very low scoring. So my question is there space for low separation birdie or die events such as the Memorial on tour, or was the Memorial rightly removed, and should this style of course be discouraged? Tyler, lead off for us.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a place for it, and it's probably right where it needs to be, in an A tier that's in between two elite events. My understanding is that just a few years ago, it was part of the pro tour. I haven't been watching long enough to know that, but it seems like that was the case. So, but that being said, I think there was a lot of buzz around the event. I personally tried to get on and watch and didn't realize that it wouldn't be, you know, covered until it would be post-produced. And so, I think people wanted to watch it. And so I do wish there was, you know, better coverage for it. When we started recording today on Tuesday morning, the final round still was not posted, and I think people want to see what happened. So I do wish that were different. But I think it probably is right where it needs to be. You know, you look at the guys who were competing, you had three up-and-coming, not even up-and-coming, just elite young guys that were, you know, in this playoff, and it would have been exciting to see. But you look at who was in the tournament, we had only three of the top 15 players competing. And so it's not an event that a lot of these guys are trying to go compete in. So it's probably not going to get any more coverage than it's already getting. But I think anytime you have three of our up-and-coming, again, current elite players that are young competing in a playoff, it's a win for the sport. And I wish we could have seen it play out, if not live, then at least sooner than Tuesday morning.
Yeah, Dustin, what do you think about the Memorial?
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same page as what he said. I mean, I think it was right to take it off the tour. I think it's fine to have this as like an A tier or a silver event because, yeah, it does still require you to throw somewhat accurate shots and execute on the putting green. But I don't see it doing what we want when we're thinking about like an elite event on the Disc Golf Pro Tour where it's supposed to be the pinnacle of the sport. And I think that's where you need to lean more into the more demanding and more technical courses to give players more diverse challenges rather than just watching a Heiser Fest for 18 holes. I think it's important to have like a mix and open wooded courses, but the wooded courses need to be fair. We need to be able to broadcast inside of them. And then with open courses, there still needs to be some challenge, whether that's a defined line that's optimal or like a gap that you still need to hit, or whether that's OB or hazards or water carries and so on and so forth. Or even like hybrid properties, right? You think of something like Idlewild that gives you a little bit of both. Or if you're at GMC, you get the contrast of those two courses. And I think that that is what we should really be leaning into to try to force people to have a variety of different shot shaping they have to do and just, you know, raise the skill ceiling of the sport, right? I think that, yeah, we can go out there with a bunch of talented players and have a bunch of people who shoot really high scores and maybe get into a playoff and, yeah, maybe somebody's having an off day, so they're just a little bit off on the putting green or whatever, and so they're not scoring as much. But I think that what's the true test is to put these players on more difficult courses, because only the elite players are going to have the skills to do well there. And that's what we want to see in the Disc Golf Pro Tour, in my opinion. And it also comes down to entertainment. I think it's just boring watching something repetitive as a viewer, and this is an entertainment industry. So that's where I'm at.
Okay, Brody, what do you think about the Birdie or Die stuff?
So the course was actually taken off tour because they weren't willing to shut down the park. So I don't know if it was necessarily, I mean, I'm sure the playing style might have factored into it, but they weren't really, the city and the people in that neighborhood weren't willing to shut down the park. And so the Pro Tour knew moving forward, they weren't going to be able to do anything there with kind of how their events have been run. I will say because Fountain Hills is Birdie or Die. It is the classic, you got to go out there and shoot in the low teens, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16 to have a shot. Vista, on the other hand, I think Vista actually is a pretty solid course. There is a lot of scoring separation out there. There are a lot of bogeys to be had. And there also are multiple shots or multiple holes where you actually have to make a decision of, do you want to play aggressive? Do you want to play more conservative? You actually have to think a little bit more out there. So I like Vista. Are we allowed to say who won? Are we doing that on this?
Yeah, well, we're going
to
talk about it later. So
okay. There's no chance if that tournament was four rounds at Fountain, there's no chance that Gannon wins. He was down 10 shots after two at Fountain. If they didn't go to Vista for those last two rounds, no shot. So Vista has the scoring separation. With that being said, I'm not a huge fan of the Birdie or Die type of courses, because I think you're eliminating one of the biggest elements of disc golf, and really, you know, let's break it down, golf in general is the mental side. The side of where you have to think, what am I trying to do from this spot? At no point at Fountain Hills, and even on a lot of the holes at Vista, you're walking up to the tee shot already having an idea of exactly what you're doing every time, and you're never changing. Wind dependent, all that stuff probably doesn't really have that much of a factor. There is stress involved with Birdie or Die, right? When you step up to a Birdie or Die course and know that you need to shoot 14, 15 under, there is that stress of like, holy cow, I've parred the first three holes. Like, oh my gosh. But to me, that's a completely different stress than stepping up to a hole and being like, last time I played this hole, I tripled this hole. Or last time I played this hole, like I could not throw this shot in bounds. So to me, those are two different types of playing styles. I think the one where it's like more stressful on the decision-making, having to strategize, having to figure that out is more interesting than the one of like showing up to a putt-putt course and being like, I'm going to try to shoot my record today of 17 under par.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely two sides to it. Hunter, what do you think about it?
Well, I think it depends on the style of Birdie or Die. Because with the current skill level of the field, I think Birdie or Die can look a lot different than the Memorial. So personally, no, I don't think there's a spot for the Memorial or event similar directly to that one on tour. But I do think there's a spot for lower separation, lower scoring or higher scoring, however you want to look at that, out there on tour. I think you can accomplish this with like maybe a little less OB, easier pin placement, some wider gaps where it still has the decision making like Brody is bringing up. But for the top of the field, it's still, you got to score, you got to get out there, you got to be aggressive, because if not, you know, you're going to be left in the dust. I mean, for example, we've seen Paul McBeth go 18 under at a tough course, and we saw him go 16 under at WR Jackson. Those are Birdie or Die scores on far from Birdie or Die courses. I'm not saying either of those courses are Birdie or Die, but as the game evolves, as the game pushes, you're going to see courses that still have the separation of the elite rising to the top, but there won't be much separation between them. And I think that is still exciting. It's not boring like the Heiser Fest, the Memorial is. I think there's a spot for that in the sport. So Birdie or Die, Yes, but not in the traditional sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, good point. I think you're right. There's a way to achieve that excitement of the low-scoring event without just having it be the wide-open, you know, Heiser course that doesn't really – I mean, I like watching Memorial every year, but as I look through the coverage, I felt all the holes kind of melting into one before my very eyes, and I was kind of like, okay – I think I'm starting to outgrow this a little bit now that I've seen so many cool courses. All right, quick points.
I was just going to say, I hope they find a way of figuring out, because like the Memorial is one of those courses that we talk about like having history and having like legacy.
Oh yeah.
So I hope they try to find an alternative course or something to like get it back on tour. Because it, like you said, for an A tier, so many people talk about it and watch it. Yeah. It'd be nice to try to find a way of getting it back on tour. Somehow.
Yeah, it's probably the biggest tournament that has been like kind of removed from the mainstream for sure. Quick points update before we head into our final subject before the rapid fire round. We've got Brody at 9, Hunter and Dustin at 12, and Tyler at 8. Heading into our last topic, this is a very open-ended topic. This is actually a question that came from one of our Patreon members, asked a similar question on our mailbag podcast, and we decided to I decided to bring this one into the show because it's very interesting. So the question is this: if a venture capitalist were to propose a donation of $20 million somewhere in the disc golf industry to further the sport, where would it be best invested, Dustin?
Right. So I think it depends on what you're trying to do. Like if you're trying to grow the sport in the sense of growing the player base, then I think there's one route to go. And if you're thinking about just improving the professional scene, there's a completely different route to go. So one road could be investing in disc golf at like the college and high school level to help kind of grow the player base, to help bring up new talent from the amateur level, and to just, you know, think that those are going to be maybe future pros or future fans or future viewers, and just grow the community at large by supporting the amateur ecosystem. But I think if we're trying to grow the pro scene, I think investing the money in the Disc Golf Pro Tour infrastructure would certainly be a way to go. You know, investing into coverage, I think, is probably one of the biggest ways to start, because then you can have more cameras, better cameras, more production crews, which means you can maybe run more than one stream. So that way people can see more of the golf that's going on the course and pick and choose what they want to watch. And what that does is that means that you could have one stream that is always free, because that's what we've always talked about, right? It's like, you know, taking away the threshold, the barrier to entry. So you could have one stream that is totally free at all times to help really raise up the viewership, which can help with sponsorships and stuff down the line. But then your diehards who are willing to pay for a premium service can still do so, and they get to watch the bonus cards or something like that that the free people aren't able to watch. So I think that's kind of one way to look at it. Also, it opens up the idea of media mergers. So bringing everything under one umbrella, if you're able to buy certain companies out and start white labeling them, I think is another big one. And then obviously the purse is another big one, right? You know, it helps bring more attention to the sport. You're going to see more headlines if more millions of dollars are on the line, and it's going to make it feel like a more viable career pursuit for amateur players, you know, that something to look up to, that like, hey, there's really some serious money there to be made.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely a lot of good spots there. Brody, where would you have that money spent?
So I said this before the show, I think this is one of the more fascinating questions that disc golf, like in the disc golf space right now. I have no idea what the right answer is. Nice. Like Dustin was saying, you can kind of go all sorts of different routes. Would that be the best? I have no flipping idea. I think the most interesting answer, as far as just to see what kind of chaos would happen, would be to just literally take the 20 million into 20 events. And at each event, you're playing for $1 million. And now obviously that money runs out real quick, right? You have 1 year of this, and then all of a sudden it's just poof, gone. Like the idea, like that probably isn't the smartest way long-term. You probably would want to kind of see, you know, that longer for a 5 year plan, 10 year plan potentially. But it would be interesting to see, because if you remember like the Paul Macbeth 10 for 10 mil, that got picked up quite a bit by news outlets outside of disc golf. And I think sometimes when you are in smaller niche sports, you kind of get in this trap of you think the sport is a lot bigger than it actually is. And when you step outside for a second, you realize that no one is talking about disc golf unless they are in disc golf. And so this would be an interesting, I think, experiment of, if you start making these purses crazy to the point of where now, like, people are gonna be like, wait, you can make a million, like you get, or, you know, $500,000 in a weekend playing disc golf, I think it could get picked up here and there. And then the other thing that would be interesting is, would there be a big shift in younger athletes looking at disc golf as a viable option in the future? I think those two things would be fascinating, but like I said, you also might just want to throw it somewhere else and see what the heck happens.
If you really had the 20 for 20 situation, 20 events with $1 million purse, you would probably see a group of athletes like never before pick up disc golf just to see if they could cash if the purses were that big. Like, I think it would be insane.
Yeah, especially when it's like you could just like randomly Monday qualify or something into these events. Yeah, it'd be nuts.
Hunter, where would you spend it?
Well, I think if someone's making this donation, you have to recognize in disc golf, or I wouldn't really say donation. I guess it should be if someone's investing this into disc golf, you have to realize this is a one-time thing. We're not going to come by this money ever again. So we have to think through, how do we maximize the long-term effect of this money? Because, yeah, it would be electric to have a $20 million tour championship purse. It would be insane. But probably not best for the growth of sports. So in my mind, it comes to investing in, first and foremost, I think live coverage equipment, like Dustin said. I think that would go a long way. Also, event development and resources. I can explain what that looks like in a little bit. But the big thing, I think, would be purchasing and developing land for home of either one of the majors or the tour championship, where we can set it up to be the end-all, be-all. I mean, I just heard this morning that Waco's even looking at possibly going to a golf course in the future.
Oh, they are.
The golf course future of the sport is because there's so many amenities that are specific and useful for disc golf, but I don't like that long term. And I think if we could use some of that money to develop that land, but other things you could do is like buy multiples of the assets you need at these events, have a storage facility, West Coast, Midwest, East Coast, and cut down some costs long term as well. You got to think through stuff like that of what can we improve quality, cut cost, and make it much more sustainable long term for the Pro Tour. So there's a lot of things you could do with it, but $20 million tour championship could be electric.
I'm just thinking, like, if you threw it at the purses, like, man, you'd really hope that season was your good season. You'd hope you'd have like a Simon like 4-win season, and like there's your retirement. Tyler, where would you have the money spent?
Well, this is so fun to think about. The best I could find, the PDGA is only worth about $5 million as it is, and so getting a $20 million donation on top of this is just like it's hard to even think about. You know how much good this could do, but. To not rehash the things that already been talked about, of course, you know, of course it's broadcast equipment. It's supporting the players. I think continuing to innovate the gear we use, continuing to innovate disc technology, whether it's just, you know, we've talked about flight numbers being inconsistent. Maybe you look at, you know, some sort of a flight number, process where they're more consistent, but you just keep improving the discs we have. I mean, you could see guys begin to throw, man, 700, 800 feet consistently if our gear keeps innovating. That could be super exciting. A couple just rapid fire ideas because I'm at the bottom of the leaderboard here and I just want to throw a couple of Hail Marys out there. I think youth outreach is a big part. Dustin mentioned this, high school, college, you know, making it a primary sport in high school to where more kids are exposed to it. I think could be awesome. I think a web series or a TV series where PDGA pros take pro athletes and coach them up to play disc golf. And then you have this massive prize that they compete in a tournament at the end, these pro athletes, and then they can, you know, use it for donations or whatever, but just getting more eyes on the sport. I think part of my new innovations idea would be developing like Top Golf, but for disc golf. I think that'd be super exciting. And I think you need money to invest in making that possible. I don't know how that would work. It's not the question. The question is, how would we invest it? I think you invest it there. And then finally, high quality nicknames for the top 50 NPO players and top 25 FPO players would be a great investment.
I think you actually hit the nail there. You mentioned the TV docuseries. $20 million, it would be kind of an all-in situation to be like, all right, this is our one chance to get that Netflix documentary that takes us to the next level. But the power of that is undeniable, and that could be a sneaky
good
one.
Who would follow? Who would you want to see 24-hour access?
I think Trevor had the idea on Rick Lock, and I think it's genius of the difference between like a player like Paul McBeth or Ricky Wysocki touring that has the million-a-year contract, and then like, I'm not going to mention a name, but like a bottom of the barrel
you
pro that's grinding
one
it.
Of each, and then you get the contrast. I think that
like
would
be fascinating. Like a Prince and a Pauper situation.
Yeah, people would be fascinated to see go from like I'm flying out first class to Waco versus I just drove here in my Prius and I'm making beans in the back seat, Ezra throwback style. Like, I think that would fascinate people.
Yeah.
But the cutting cost infrastructure, hey, I think we have all the good ideas. So
I think Hunter had his best answer of debate night history.
That was a good answer.
Which one?
Hunter was eating.
No, the last one. No, the last one.
That was
the last question.
Answer.
I think that was your best.
No, I was saying like which part of it? Just my
answer. I think all of it. I think all of it. I think if you're like trying to be on the board, which I don't know if that does anything, but if you're trying, you have my vote.
Oh, sick.
Hunter for board of directors. Let's start the campaign right now.
Trevor, are you a mole where we were just like free consultants for this golf?
I actually am taking a very large payday. I can't. Okay. I'm kidding.
Let
it's
me
a
get
joke.
My think tank
there's
together.
There's too many lawsuits.
A couple of dollars.
There's too many lawsuits going around right now that I feel like I have to tell everybody that was a joke.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
you're allegedly game paid. You're allegedly game paid.
No, there's not even alleged.
No, it's alleged.
All right. Well, Hunter and Dustin are in the lead at 16, tied up. So we're going to head into our rapid fire round.
It's a tale as old as time, isn't it, Hunter?
It is. We're back in our duel.
Back again.
Today's rapid fire round is brought to you by the Heiser Club. Shout out to all of our Heiser Club members, part of the Foundation Disc Golf Patreon program. If you go to patreon.com/FoundationDiscGolf, you can check out the Heiser Club. We have a few different tiers where you can check out things such as exclusive weekly podcasts and exclusive monthly videos. We've got a special store, special discounts that you can get through that program. And right now, if you sign up, you can get a 30-day free trial to try out all the benefits and see if it's for you without paying anything. So if you want to check out the Heiser Club, patreon.com/FoundationDiscGolf, make sure to check that out. We're into our rapid fire round now. We've got some pretty good topics here. And we've got Hunter and Dustin all tied up at 16. It's another duel. Are you guys tied in wins right now, if I remember correctly? Or is it 2-2?
Overall wins, yes. He's okay. Up 2-1 on me.
Okay, so there's something to fight for here.
I'm
fighting
here. Yeah.
All right, first topic, and I think this is actually a topic we may have to bring back. I kind of thought of this one, but it was rehashed for me when I was watching the first event of the year, and I was kind of just like, not so sure about that. And it's been talked about a lot before, but the question is, should players be allowed to wear headphones during the round? Why or why not? We'll do this the way we did it before. Since you guys are tied up, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. Dustin, what do you think it is?
6.
Hunter?
4.
The number was 6 yet again. Dustin, would you like to go first or second?
I'll go first.
Okay, so Dustin, lead off for us. Headphones, why or why not?
All right, so the current rule basically says that your volume level is supposed to not be able to be heard by other players, that it's not supposed to prevent you from your duties as a scorekeeper and like watching what's going on for provisionals and all that jazz. And it's also a safety thing where you should be able to still hear four calls, and that if you fail to be able to do these things, then you're going to get penalized as a courtesy violation. I think that there's so many gray areas there. Like, how do I know if this person can still hear everything, if they are still able to be safe? You know, yeah, obviously I can know whether I can hear their music or not, but when it comes to some of these other gray areas, I feel like it's a little bit hard to know. Also, there's the whole performance enhancing aspect where it can help with your mental game, help you deal with distractions or like pressure. But it's also like a metronome to help you with swing tempo. Or how do we know they're not getting information from someone up the fairway about the wind or something like that? Right. We don't know what they're hearing. Like, how are you going to enforce that throughout the course of a tournament or a round or what have you? So I think the way to avoid all these gray areas that I'm speaking of is just to get rid of them. I think that's just the easy solution.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of good points there, Hunter. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I don't think that they should be allowed. I don't like the optics of it. I also think it could provide an advantage, but I don't think either of those two reasons are the reason to get rid of them. I think it's more so kind of to what Dustin was alluding. It's like, there's a reason that all those rules aren't what the rules are when you're driving a car. Because, like, you can't have headphones on when you're driving a car because you got to be aware of what's going around you. You got to be aware of the police coming up behind you when you can hear them. And yeah, you can make all these statements of X, Y, and Z, restrictions on volume level, restrictions on blah, blah, blah. It's a lot easier for you to say, hey, you can't have them in. I mean, you see this in running races, like lower level races, C tiers, as far as like PDGA goes, who cares? When you get to higher end races, you got to have them out because you got to be aware of what's going on around you. And it also gets rid of the possible mental advantage where you got to just be out there battling yourself, battling the course. So no, I don't think there's any room for headphones in actual rounds.
Yeah, I think it's about the kind of potential. Because do I firmly believe that probably every player using headphones right now is just listening to music to calm their nerves? Yes. And do I think that's a huge deal? No, not really, because it's accessible to everybody. However, the issue comes into play, like Dustin mentioned, the idea of the metronome as a training aid. Like, is that something we want to allow training aids in a tournament round? And then the bigger one, how do we know somebody, a coach, isn't on the other end giving them like, hey, I'm breaking down video right now of your last throw and I'm telling you what you just did wrong. Or I'm standing down the fairway, and by the way, the wind is a crosswind up here. Like, there are some serious implications, and I think that's why people on social media will be quick to be like, they're just listening to music. It's not a big deal. Well, it's about what could happen. So I think there's some good points there. All right, point number two. Right now, Dustin has a one-point lead after the first topic. Hunter, you'll lead off here. So Gannon won the Memorial in A-tier. We know how Hunter feels about A-tiers. Should we care about this, and how much, Hunter?
First off, you don't know how I feel about A-tiers. You know how I feel about silver events.
You said A-tiers yesterday.
It's very basic to me. It's very easy to mix those two up because they both don't matter. So my question is, why aren't we mentioning Joel Freeman's win at the Crush on the Conch Show or whatever it's called? Mm. Also had some big names there. If we look at the strength of the field angle, it also had a decent strength of field if you're considering A-tiers. But the deal is, Stat Mando gave Vegas a strength of field of 67, gave the Memorial only a 23. The only reason we're bringing it up is it has history. You take away the history, it's just another A-tier, and guess what? We're all going to forget who won it a few weeks from now anyways. Should we care? Yeah, it was cool. We saw the future of the sport on display, but the top guys weren't there. We can't really care that much.
All right. Dustin, do you care?
I care a small amount because obviously I think for me it's the Gannon Burr story angle where he's clearly going through a lot at the moment. And so for him to be able to score a win in that situation, I think it's like kind of at least a promising look for him that it's not impacting him. And hopefully that means he's going to be set straight for the rest of the tour. And there were a couple of decent players there, but it wasn't a total walk. It wasn't a total walk in the park is kind of what I'm getting at. But the bottom line is that Burr was the only player ranked in the top 10 at the tournament. And there were only three other top 20 players in attendance. That was Isaac Robinson, AB, and Drew Gibson. So super weak field overall. It's a super soft course. And so at the end of the day, I'll give Burr some credit for getting a win due to what he's going through. But, I mean, it was a weak field, a weak course, all that jazz. Like, yeah, I don't really care too much.
Yeah, I think you guys kind of nailed it. It's something to be said to beat the players that were there, but you can never really judge it when the strength of field is that low and the style, of course. But you're right, though, also, Dustin, with what's going on with Gannon, I think anywhere he is, especially the beginning of the season, is going to be interesting to look at. All right, we're all tied up at 23 going into our last subject here. We'll see who can give the most convincing argument, I suppose. Who is the player to watch at Waco this weekend, Dustin?
All right, so I'm going to pick what I know is kind of the obvious one, but it's going to be Kristen Tatar. And the reason for this is, first of all, she's coming off of injury, so we don't know what kind of condition she's in. This will kind of give us a look at how healthy she is. Also, she hasn't played since the Pro Tour Championship last year, so she didn't play any wraparound events, any local events to tune up her game, anything like that. So we don't know where her game is at right now, which is interesting to see at Waco. Also, last year at Waco, she was the runner-up. She lost to Valerie Mandahano. So now it'll be like, well, can she get the win this year? Like, can she start off with a dub? I think the bigger thing that we're looking at is, can she keep up the consistency from last year? Because it's incredible. She never placed outside of the podium at Elite Series or higher events for the entire season. That's a bonker streak. Not to mention the amount of cash that she pulled in along the way being like a crazy like achievement. So it's like, can she actually keep that up? Can she do that again? Because if that's the case, all of a sudden you're shifting that GOAT argument quite a lot, in future years, so she can keep this up. So that's where I'm at.
I mean, when you're trying to compare to last season and the standard is you can't finish off the podium at this event, it's pretty early. It's going to set in pretty quick. Hunter, who's your player to watch at Waco?
So for me, Waco is always a wild one. So I more so look at this event less as a tell of what the top talent's doing and more so like this is a great chance for a player to have a breakout win or at least a breakout performance. I mean, we've seen Colton Montgomery do it. We've seen Kona Panis do it. Luke Humphreys almost did it. We've seen a lot of weird winners out there. So I'm going more so just gut. This player's also been, he played pretty solid at Vegas. Rough year at Waco last year, but historically decently solid at Waco. And that's Emerson Keith. I think Waco, especially if you look at the statistics, there's not one stat that you have to be really good at out at Waco. You just have to have an overall very solid, very put together game. And Emerson can be streaky, but we saw it at 2019 Worlds. When he's at his best, he has a very solid, very put together game. And for some reason, I don't have stats for this one. My gut is just telling me that we're about to see the streaky Emerson Keith come out. And I think he's going to actually have a chance of taking this thing down. So I really like Waco as a one that, you know, it can just be your one big event, one big win. I think that might be Emerson's this weekend.
You know what, Hunter? I'm gonna give it to you. You had a great show today. I'm gonna give you the edge. I like Emerson as well. I think his good showing at Vegas points to potentially keeping up that momentum too. Has it on his side. So you know what, Hunter put together a great show today.
Gamer Daddy.
Dustin always.
I was hoping you'd say it.
Dustin is always with a great fight, but Hunter, you had a few answers there in that tournament that was just. They were just tough to beat. So I'm going to give it to you today, 28-27. I believe so that evens up the series now, 2-2 between you guys. So that's something that you're going to have to keep an eye on if you're a fan of the show as it goes on. Every time Hunter and Dustin end up in a battle, it ends up very close, and I get very anxious about who's going to win. All right, Hunter, victory lap. What do you have to say?
Yeah, I kind of want to respond actually to Brody's beginning. I saw a lot of the comments too. We got heated last week, and you know, I just want to take this chance to apologize to absolutely no one. The triple champ does what the? I'm just kidding, man. It was a great time. I always love being able to be on this show, and you know, I'm glad to have taken it down again.
I love how you messed that up. It's the double champ.
But I'm a triple champ now.
Oh, okay. Oh, you didn't mess it up. I'm bad with nicknames too. Yeah.
All right, everybody. Well, that was another episode of Debate Night.
I did try and nickname myself Tentacles my freshman year.
See, that's the type of stuff we need to come out on this show.
Ultimate. It did not stick. I was the only one calling myself Tentacles.
Yeah, we'll bring our Tentacles stamped disc coming soon.
Yeah, Tentacles coming soon.
That would be a sick disc with like an octopus just all over the place.
All right, calm down.
There we go.
All right.
You got to make it stick first. If you make it stick, then we can maybe we'll look
at it. I couldn't do it in college.
You got
no
chance now. All right.
Another shot.
Well, another episode with the cast, Tentacles, Tyler, Dustin, and Hunter. And we'll see you again in the next episode next week. If you're looking at the show and you think you'd like to audition, we're always looking for new cast members. Make sure to reach out to us so we can have you try out. Other than that, we'll see you next episode.